New year, new me! Forget it. And ladies, we need to talk. We're keeping it real. We're calling out wellness industry nonsense, Ozempic and its influence, and how our relentless striving for perfection is actually bad for us. So join us for the anti-New Year's resolution and start 2026 on the right foot. Search Ladies, We Need to Talk on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that in this episode, we're going to be discussing an Aboriginal person who has died. The Northern Territory coroner was in a courtroom when she delivered her findings into Kumanjai Walker's death. She was sitting at a plastic table in the remote community of Yundamu, where he lived and died. I'm Stephen Stockwell. This is Chapter 5 of the case of Kumanjai Walker.
Constable Zachary Rolfe fatally shot the 19-year-old.
Sometimes I think about how he must have felt in his last moments. Was he scared?
And I can promise you, consequences will flow.
Constable Rolfe has pleaded not guilty to one charge of murder.
Prosecutors took the case to the High Court.
There's been a huge outpouring of grief.
An organisation with significant hallmarks of institutional racism.
When we are going to get justice? When?
By mid-2025, the inquest into the death of Kumanjai Walker had been running for years. It had been more than half a decade since Kumanjai Walker was shot by Zachary Rolfe, and Mel, finally, everything was kind of starting to come to a head.
This had been such a long road for everybody involved in the case, and it was almost unbelievable and difficult to comprehend that it was coming to an end.
The inquest findings were handed down in Yundamu, and this is after the coroner had spent years hearing about Zachary Rolfe's potted police history, Kumanjai's upbringing, and also these racist police awards that we spoke about in our last episode. Mel, you were there on the day the findings were being handed down. What was it like? What was the environment in that community?
It was really quiet in Yundamu on the day that the findings were handed down. I had gotten there really early to file live crosses to our news breakfast program. And so my cameraman and I, who had also been with me pretty much this entire time, we sat and watched the sunrise over Yundamu. And it was this really strange feeling that, you know, after so many years, after so much pain and trauma that this community had been through, it was really strange that we were seeing this finally happen.
Because there were so many delays getting to this point, right, Mel? I mean, you know, so many delays through the process of the inquest, but also in getting to hand down the findings, because there were things happening up until the final weeks that kept pushing this back further and further.
Yeah, another young Walpiri man, Kumanjai White, who was also from Yundamu, was related to a lot of the same people as Kumanjai Walker. Kumanjai White also died in police custody just a week or so before the coroner was due to hand down her findings into Kumanjai Walker's death. And so the findings were delayed further because the community now had this fresh grief to have to deal with before taking on this other massive report from the coroner.
Mm. And I mean, you say massive report. You know, we've talked about how long this report took to compile. You know, it was kind of years in the making, right? And the report she produces is gigantic in its own right, a 680-page document. And Elizabeth Armitage, the Northern Territory coroner, actually delivered her findings live on the ABC News channel, sitting at this plastic table in Yundamu, surrounded by red dirt and the community that the Kumanjai Walker was shot in. What did she find?
Ultimately, the coroner found that Kumanjai Walker's death was avoidable, that Zachary Rolfe and his team made flawed decisions on the night that he was shot, that he had jettisoned this 5 a.m. arrest plan that we talked a lot about in the previous episodes, and that Zachary Rolfe held racist views and that he benefited from a police force that she found had all the hallmarks of structural racism.
I found it really interesting how specific Elizabeth Armitage was at this point in the findings of the report that she hands down. She found that Zachary Rolfe didn't shoot Kumanjai Walker because he was racist, even though by her count he was racist. Instead, his racist views increased the likelihood of a fatal shooting. Have I got that right? Have I read that properly?
Yeah, that's I guess the simplest way to put it. The coroner found that she couldn't necessarily prove that his racism was the cause of Kumanjai Walker's death, but she said that she also couldn't really rule that out. But instead, the coroner found that his views, both about race, about police officers in remote communities, bush cops, about women, that his quote-unquote unsavory views contributed in some way to his decision-making on the night that Kumanjai Walker died. And his decision-making that led to police putting themselves in what she referred to as a dangerous situation in the first place, that ultimately led to Zachary Rolfe making that decision to fire his weapon on that night.
The report is really quite damning around the Northern Territory Police, and especially Zachary Rolfe and his conduct around this night, you know, talking about how this whole thing was really avoidable. You know, if he'd followed the plan or if he had not approached in certain ways or not done certain things at certain times, there's all these ways this ends in a different way. There is so much detail in the coroner's report, and I mean, we're not going to be able to do it justice. As I mentioned, it's 680 pages, so we'll put the full report in the episode description, and also some of Mel's reporting, so you can read a bit more about all of that. And it was just kind of incredible reading through this report, Mel, just about how much the coroner has learned, knows about that night and the situation and the circumstances that have led to it. What surprised you in those findings, though? I mean, did we learn much more about, you know, the specifics of what unfolded on that night in Yuendumu?
We did. I mean, the coroner went through in great detail everything that led to the point of Kumanjai Walker being shot on the 9th of November in 2019. She went back to Kumanjai Walker's upbringing and she spelled out all of the difficulties that he faced as a young person, losing his parents as a young baby. He was really ill as a little boy. He witnessed violence growing up and, you know, had all of these struggles that we've kind of talked about in previous episodes. She went back to Zachary Rolfe's training and she went into great detail about training in general by police or for police and recruitment of police officers. She talked about and made findings about the immediate response team, that team that went out to Yuendumu on the night, which has since been disbanded, that the way that that team itself was structured. The coroner was really strong in her language. I think that was something that really surprised me, how straight down the line she was about these findings of racism and structural racism within the Northern Territory Police Force and within government agencies as a whole. She was really clear and straight to the point about what she thought had contributed to Kumanjai Walker's death.
Yeah. And there was also findings that directly contradicted things we had heard through other parts of this process as well. You know, when we were talking through, I think it was in one of the trial episodes, actually, Zachary Rolfe talking about how Kumanjai Walker's hand was on his gun. And the coroner found that was actually not what happened.
The coroner found that Zachary Rolfe had been dishonest in his evidence. She found that he lied when he said that Kumanjayi Walker's hand was on his gun during that struggle when he was shot.
She found that there were, you know, clearly racist elements within that police force. It's really quite damning of the NT police. Did she have anything nice to say about them?
Yeah, she did. And the coroner obviously had dug really deep into the racism element of the Northern Territory Police Force and of the evidence that she heard. But she also found that there are a lot of really hardworking, sensitive police officers in the Northern Territory Police Force. She said that many of the officers who came to give evidence to the court really impressed her as both curious and culturally sensitive, people who had dedicated their working lives to serving Aboriginal people in Aboriginal communities, and that there is a lot of work going on behind the scenes within the Northern Territory Police Force to improve relationships between Aboriginal communities and police officers. But she did find that racism was widespread within the police force, and that that was something that would taint the force for years to come.
Yeah, that's something I'm looking forward to talking a bit more about in our next episode, kind of how all these organisations have kind of dealt with these findings. And, I mean, as well as the findings that Elizabeth Armitage makes, and they are the bulk of this 680-page report, I was kind of reading through, looking for recommendations, and I will admit I did not read the entire 680 pages, but I did have to scroll past a lot of them to get to the recommendations, of which there are 33, all kind of designed to prevent something like this happening again. And after how shocking the findings of Elizabeth Armitage were, I found the recommendations so matter of fact, like so sensible, so practical. You know, there were things like mutual respect agreements with local Indigenous communities, developing anti-racism strategies, improving Indigenous staffing rates, community-led night patrols, all these sort of activities to engage young people, diversion programs, all this kind of stuff through communities that seems so practical. Mel, from the 33 recommendations, what sort of stood out to you?
One recommendation that I had been anticipating throughout this whole process was I was really curious to see what the coroner was going to find or recommend when it came to guns in remote communities. Because one of the really loud calls from many senior members of the Yuendumu community were for police not to carry guns in communities. And we heard a lot of evidence on sort of both sides of that argument. You know, police said that they needed to carry weapons to do their jobs. That's part of, you know, their sort of suite of things that they have with them to be able to do their jobs and to be able to do their jobs well. And then we also heard from members of the community that guns were unnecessary and that they felt that they, you know, didn't need to be carried around in general when police are just sort of out and about in the community doing patrols and that sort of thing. So the coroner didn't go as far as to say that police shouldn't be armed at all. She didn't say that they shouldn't carry guns, but that police should find ways to work with local communities to come to agreements about when guns could or couldn't be carried. She sort of recommended that these agreements be between those local officers and that local community that they're working in, so that it isn't going to be a, you know, one size fits all kind of agreement between communities, because that view that police shouldn't carry guns isn't, you know, something that every single Aboriginal person in every single Aboriginal community holds, you know, but that this is something that police could work towards with each individual community that they work in, you know, that whether guns are kept in a safe in police cars or whether in some communities guns are carried by police everywhere that they go. So she sort of made this recommendation that really kind of, I suppose, left that decision with police and the community that they're working in.
Yeah, I think the thing that stood out to me from a lot of the findings was this this kind of co-design process. You know, a lot of recommendations that, you know, these various government bodies, and it kind of points to the Northern Territory government, the Northern Territory Police, the Northern Territory Health, you know, when they're making decisions, they should be working with the First Nations communities that they are trying to serve at those times. And I think the one that kind of was the most obvious to me, or really kind of underlined that in a way that resonates through the way we've been telling this story, was about how, you know, when nurses leave a remote community without any nurses, that's something that shouldn't happen unless there's been a conversation with the community before the decision is made.
Yeah, ultimately, with these 33 recommendations, I suppose the common theme was that the coroner was really recommending that government agencies work with remote communities rather than just working in remote communities.
And Mel, I mean, just as you're talking about the guns out of communities kind of recommendation, I'm thinking back to Elizabeth Armitage, you know, delivering her findings in Yindamu, sitting at this plastic table outside, you know, just in the desert air. And as she's doing this, there's this banner behind her basically saying the same thing, guns out of communities, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting that you bring that up, Stocky, because this was something that was ultimately quite contentious after the findings were handed down. The coroner, you know, isn't in a traditional courtroom setting as she normally would be to hand down coronial findings. She was in Yindamu, as you say, at a plastic table in the middle of the community. And as she sits down, behind her, some people hang this banner representing a community group that is calling for no guns in communities, for a ceasefire. And this is a group that the coroner had heard quite a bit from throughout the process of this coronial inquest. It was a group of senior elders, families and community members from the Walpuri Nation calling predominantly for a police ceasefire, but also making several other demands. And so this banner kind of appearing behind the coroner in that moment became quite contentious.
Yeah, right. I mean, Mel, is this also the same group that during the inquest talked about, you know, traditional punishment for Zachary Rolfe shooting Kumanjai Walker?
Yeah, it is. The evidence that we heard around traditional punishment was something that was really important for members of the community to have the coroner hear. You know, we heard a lot of what Yapa said were misinterpretations about payback, which is an English word for a Walpuri custom. And so there's already that sort of tension, I suppose, in trying to explain this concept to a coronial courtroom. And as a white reporter, I can explain this only, you know, so far as what we heard in court and what I reported on throughout this inquest. But it was quite clear that members of this group, members of the Yindamu community, wanted the coroner to have an understanding of what customary law in Yindamu looked like. We heard a lot of evidence from members of the community, particularly when the coroner visited Yindamu, about this idea of a spear across the legs of Constable Zachary Rolfe being the sort of traditional punishment for the death of Kumanjaya Walker. And I'm going to quote Ned Jumpanjipa Hargraves here, a senior elder of the Yindamu community, talking about payback being an organised cultural ceremony. He said, you know, it's a gathering of the whole community who witness it. People have roles and responsibilities to the person who has passed away. This is something that has been happening forever. He said, deep in our hearts, deep in our minds, we want to see justice. And so justice for them looks very different to what justice in the court is able to deliver.
Amel, you're talking there about a spear across the legs. Is that a spear in the legs?
Stocky, the language that we heard throughout the coronial process was a spear across the legs being the traditional punishment for the death of Kumanjai Walker.
You know, it's interesting as well hearing this traditional Walpi law in the context of a Western justice system as well. I mean, I can imagine it would have been, I guess, not hard for, you know, Elizabeth Armitage to listen to that. That's kind of the easy part. But the harder part is trying to figure out how that can then kind of mesh or gel with the Western justice system.
So it was a really clear example of how difficult the balance is, I suppose, in this context, to balance traditional culture and the colonial laws in which the coroner has to operate in.
Yeah. And I mean, you talk about the balance and, you know, the coroner is kind of an impartial body within all of that. But, I mean, was it problematic that there was a banner behind her from one of the parties as she was delivering her findings?
That became the basis of a complaint filed by Zachary Rolfe to the Judicial Commission in the Northern Territory. There were accusations of bias because that banner was hanging behind the coroner as she delivered her findings. Ultimately, that complaint was dismissed, largely because the coroner didn't appear to be aware that banner had been hung behind her while she was delivering her findings. And as you say, because this was broadcast on the ABC News channel, the whole thing was filmed, and you can see in it that the coroner has sat down and has her back to this banner as it's being hung. And so it was found that the coroner wasn't aware that was there, and so therefore there was no finding of bias against the coroner in that context.
Yeah, and I mean, did we hear much from Zachary Rolfe following the inquest findings being handed down outside of that complaint? I mean, he wasn't on trial here, so I guess he doesn't have to, but did he say anything?
Yeah, Zachary Rolfe released a statement through his lawyers not long after the findings were handed down, and he was very critical of the coroner's findings, which had criticised him, rejecting the findings of racism and that had any impact on his thinking on the night of the shooting. He accused the coroner of infantilising Indigenous communities, and he said that ultimately that the inquest itself was a misallocation of valuable time and resources. He said that it missed a critical opportunity to propose genuinely beneficial and impactful reforms. And so that was a statement that he released through his lawyers not long after the findings were handed down. I also separately received a statement from Zachary Rolfe's lawyers implying that they would appeal the findings of the coroner, you know, saying that perhaps the Supreme Court would be an appropriate place to go through what the coroner had just found.
Could you do that?
You can, yes. It's kind of a complicated legal avenue that you can go down. You can sort of take coronial findings up to the Supreme Court for review. The ultimate decisions that could come from that could be that the certain elements of the findings could be dismissed, that the findings as a whole could be dismissed. Ultimately, it is open to the Supreme Court to rule that the whole inquest has to start again.
Right. I mean, you know, that's not something that has happened in this instance, so we haven't had another multi-year coronial inquest. We talked about the findings, the recommendations within this mail. A number of those findings and recommendations relate to the Northern Territory government. How did they react following these being handed down?
The government hasn't yet handed down its sort of formal response to these findings. That's a process that goes through the parliament, and that hasn't happened yet. They have, you know, several months to be able to do that. But we have heard commentary, I suppose, from members of the government. The Northern Territory's Chief Minister, Leah Finocchiaro, you know, welcomed the end of this process when it happened. And some of her first comments really about the findings being handed down came down to the cost of this inquest as a whole. You know, we heard that overall around $8 million had been spent on legal fees and the associated costs for this coronial inquest. A lot of those legal fees were for the Northern Territory Police Force itself. And so some of the first commentary that we heard from Leah Finocchiaro, the Chief Minister, was around whether or not they would review the legislation around the coroner's office to, I suppose, rein in some of that spending and the scope of this inquiry.
Right. Doesn't sound like that really gets to the points that the coroner was making in the report. While the NT government's kind of reacted in that way, you know, again, a lot of recommendations around the Northern Territory Police, a lot of, you know, quite damning findings. And they seem like they've actually kind of tried to do a bit of work, or at least, you know, responding in a slightly more proactive way.
The police commissioner, Martin Dole, was pretty quick to accept a lot of these findings and recommendations. Again, there hasn't yet been sort of this formal response to the recommendations or a formal commitment to implementing them. But Martin Dole made it quite clear that a lot of what the coroner had recommended was sort of already afoot within the police force. They had heard the evidence as it was coming out throughout this process, that it was being reported that there were these racist awards being handed out, that there was this use of racist language and racial slurs, and all of these problems that the coroner was hearing about as they were coming to light. It was quite clear that the police force was paying attention to this evidence. So the police force has since developed and made public an anti-racism strategy. That was one of the coroner's recommendations, and they had clearly already been working on that before the findings were handed down. You know, I didn't get the sense from the police commissioner that he was sort of shying away from these findings and recommendations at the time that they were handed down. It's quite clear that there is a lot of work for them to do in this space.
Yeah. Finally, Mel, what about the family of Kumanjai Walker? I mean, this process started because he was shot by Zachary Rolfe. Did this report, these findings, these recommendations satisfy them?
Yes and no. I think, you know, based on my conversations with members of the community after the findings were handed down, you know, there was this sort of sense of relief that the process was over. People felt really validated by the findings of systemic racism. You know, this is something that Yuppa had been talking about, had been calling out for generations. And so to hear the coroner, a judge of the Northern Territory, formally find systemic racism within the Northern Territory Police Force was something really significant and validating for a lot of people. They did, however, want some of those findings and recommendations to go a little bit further, particularly when it comes to the oversight of police. We heard members of Kumanjai Walker's community saying that they don't want police investigating police at all in these sorts of contexts. They didn't want police to be the ones that investigate their colleagues after a member of the community has been killed. There was also, as we have spoken about already, that desire for police not to carry guns in remote communities. And that wasn't a formal recommendation that the coroner made. As well as sort of how I summarised it in my reporting, we also heard a lot from Kumanjai Walker's cousin, Samara Fernandez Brown, and here's some of her reflections.
A call to action would be an independent ombudsman for NT police complaints. I think at the moment when you've got police investigating police, it inherently puts mob on the back foot in that sense, because you don't feel safe that they're going to be taken seriously. As we saw throughout the coronial inquest, there is entrenched racism, and that comes from the top all the way through to the bottom. So I think, again, just a removal from the NT police looking after mob, especially if they've been violent towards them, and moving to an ombudsman at the moment would be great. But obviously, ultimately, we want community control because I think mob have solutions, and I would love there to be a focus that's more strength-based and program-based that is led by mob, because we just want a better future for our young people.
That's Samara Fernandez-Brown, the cousin of Kumanjai Walker. Mel, in our next episode, we're going to talk about what's happened in the 6 months since this report has been handed down. But, you know, something that I've found myself thinking about as we've been talking through the reaction of Kumanjai Walker's family is something that the coroner put right at the beginning of her report. She made this kind of real point about the context that this shooting happened in, this context of violence against First Nations people from colonizers, basically since colonization. And it set a really interesting tone for kind of how I then thought about and read the rest of that report.
Yeah, the coroner made a real point to talk about the history of white Australia. And, you know, she made reference to the Coniston Massacre in 1928, which was the last recorded state-sanctioned massacre of Aboriginal people, which happened not far from Yuendumu, and that there are elders still living in the community who lost relatives in that massacre, and, you know, that those stories were still quite fresh for a lot of people. And so whilst there is generations between the trauma of colonisation and people living in Yuendumu today, the coroner made it quite clear that she, you know, was acknowledging that those scars still run quite deep, and that the context in which Kumanjai Walker was killed, whilst it was very different for people living in Yuendumu, it was history repeating itself.
Mel, in our next episode, we're going to talk through what has changed in the 6 months since these findings were handed down. You know, there's 33 recommendations, there's, you know, a bevy of findings relating to the NT government, the NT police, NT health, and we're going to talk through what's happened or what's changed since they were handed down. We're also going to be answering your questions as well. So if you have any questions you'd like Mel and I to dive into, please get in touch, thecaseof@abc.net.au. We'll be back in your feed on Thursday. The Case of Kumanjai Walker is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Melissa McKay and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller, and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. Thank you to senior lawyer Jasmine Sims, to senior cultural advisor Miriam Korowa, and to editorial policies advisor Bridget Caldwell-Bright for their help making this episode. This episode was produced on the land of the Gadigal and Wurundjeri people.